argument. We're kind of chuckling a little bit in terms of getting ready to go because of all of the matters that arose with the broken water pipe, which apparently got cured overnight. We thought it would be a 5-week delay, and then we find out early this morning everything's ready to go. But anyway, I want to thank you, attorneys, for changing on such short notice and trying to comply with what we're doing at the Court of Appeals to get our hearings live and up and going, and now having it unfortunately reduced back to Zoom again today. So with that, welcome. We are about to address our court hearings for today, January 19th, 2022. Bethany Anderson is our marshal, and I'll ask her to call court to order.
The Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Ross, Judge Larkin, the Honorable Renee L. Werke presiding.
The rules of appellate procedure remain in place, despite the fact that we are appearing by Zoom, except, of course, you don't have to stand. We wouldn't know if you were standing or not based on our view from this side. If there's any technical issue that either of you have, wave your hand or do something, and I'll have our time clock stop so that we can attend to what the tech issue is. Speaking of the time, each of you has 15 minutes to present your case in chief. There is an additional 5 minutes that's reserved to appellate counsel for rebuttal if you choose to utilize that. And I'm now going to ask our marshal to call the first case for consideration.
This is case number A210737, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Tracy Dean Bullock, appellant.
Is it pronounced Kittle?
That's correct.
When you're ready to proceed, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Opposing counsel, and may it please the court. My name is Max Kittle. I'm an attorney with the State Public Defender. I represent appellant Tracy Bullock in this matter. The district court abused its discretion in denying Mr. Bullock's motion for a downward dispositional departure when it made remorse a necessary condition to grant a downward dispositional departure. The Minnesota Supreme Court made clear in Soto that remorse is not a necessary condition for granting a dispositional departure. And the language used by the Court of Appeals in Soto and the district court here are strikingly similar. Just as the Soto Court of Appeals said, quote, his, Soto's, lack of remorse is impossible to reconcile with a dispositional departure, the sentencing court here said, quote, but the one thing that I needed to hear from you today was that you are sorry and that you take responsibility. And at no step along the way have you done that. Both the Soto Court of Appeals and the district court here made remorse a necessary condition for staying a presumptively executed sentence. This erroneous view of the law was an abuse of discretion. We ask that you reverse and remand with direction to impose a probationary sentence. And
in we often deal with abuse of discretion as far as our review of what the district court did or didn't do, but you certainly have an uphill battle because the court didn't have to do anything, didn't have to take into consideration any of the mitigating factors and could have just pronounced sentence as it chose to do that. What are the factors that you think would compel a court to dispose of this case in a different matter that would bring it to the level that would need approval if you were the state and decided to appeal?
First of all, it is the erroneous view of the law that I think is most important here, and the erroneous view of the law by the district court that remorse was a necessary condition. The district court made clear the one thing holding it back in this case was the fact that the defendant didn't show remorse and didn't take responsibility.
Wait a second. Can I press you on that a little bit? I'm not, I want to make sure you sufficiently answered Judge Warkey's question, but I have a question about the assertion that the district court relied exclusively on that proposition. I'm not sure that's so, but before I get to that, go ahead and make sure you're completing Judge Warkey's answer.
Absolutely. Thank you, Your Honor. And I think the fact that the abuse of discretion includes an erroneous view of the law, and it's clear that the district court here had an erroneous view of the law that completely matched the Court of Appeals decision in Soto, so that we do have an erroneous view of the law. But going further, the decision to deny the dispositional departure based solely on the fact that Mr. Bullock continued to maintain his innocence also went against logic and all the facts on the record. Mr. Bullock made clear from the moment he talked to police that night that he maintained his innocence and had no wrongdoing in whatever incident occurred that night. He maintained his innocence through every hearing and certainly maintained his innocence at the plea hearing. And yet, at the plea hearing, the district court accepted the plea, knew that Mr. Bullock was going to be requesting a dispositional departure, and certainly didn't say there's no chance at a dispositional departure unless you accept remorse for this and show remorse and take responsibility. So to decide then going forward that the only thing holding him back was a lack of remorse when it was clear based on his Alford plea and his maintaining his innocence, that was an abuse of discretion, and the erroneous view of the law was also an abuse of discretion. Judge Ross.
Okay, so I want to go to that, the point that you're pressing on, I think you're relying on mostly, if not exclusively. What are the specific words that the district court used that would lead us to agree with you that the district court refused to depart downward specifically and exclusively because your client continued to claim his innocence or refused to accept responsibility?
And I've used this quote before, and I do think I'm hammering on it a little bit, but it really is the quote, "But the one thing that I needed to hear from you today, the one thing that I needed to hear from you today was that you are sorry and that you take responsibility. At no step along the way have you done that." And a little bit further on in the sentencing transcript, at the end of page 22 and the beginning of page 23, the district court does make it clear, I don't think this was a personal decision, that Judge Olmstead needed to personally hear that he showed remorse, but it does appear that it was a legal requirement, that she believed she had a legal requirement to...
Can't that also be read, though, or inferred that the sentencing judge was weighing remorse against the other factors?
There's nothing
explicit that says that this is a factor. You know, I guess I'm thinking you can read it both ways, and I'm asking you why not? Why would I not interpret that remark as a judge that is actually weighing lack of remorse against other factors that may have been compelling?
I think an important part of the sentencing transcript is that end of 22, beginning of 23, and the quote is, "And yet I cannot justify a departure in this case based on the way the law reads and based on the fact that what you did falls so squarely within, I think, exactly what the law and the statute prescribe as the outcome here." That shows that Judge Olmstead was considering it a legal requirement.
It sounds in context that what the judge was saying was your conduct squarely met the elements of the offense.
And that would go to the downward durational departure, but it wouldn't play a part in the argument for a downward dispositional departure. Since we're only challenging on appeal the downward dispositional departure, the focus of appellant has certainly been on the dispositional departure and those factors.
You're not arguing that acceptance of responsibility or remorse are not, you're not arguing that these are factors the district court is precluded from considering.
The footnote in Soto does certainly suggest that this question is coming. And I do believe that this question is squarely presented here. To get to a reverse and remand for resentencing, I don't think that element needs to be met. I think the fact that we have an abuse of discretion based...
My question is, you're not suggesting, I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, that district courts at sentencing are precluded from considering either the defendant's remorse or lack of remorse as a factor.
No, absolutely not.
Let's press on that a little bit. So this case is a little bit different from the typical Alford case, I think. Let me ask it in this way. If the circumstances convince the district court that the defendant is actually guilty, I mean, that they're not just that the defendant is guilty as a matter of law by virtue of the guilty plea, the Alford plea, but that the claims of innocence are so refuted by the circumstances that the district court sort of disregard the claims of innocence as it considers whether the defendant is accepting responsibility. And I'll just frame it. In this case, we know not just that there's a claim that he was pointing, your client was pointing a, well, in this case, we have We have witnesses that corroborate. We have evidence that was found apparently in your client's home that is consistent with the statements that were made by the witnesses. And if you put that together, the district court might be unimpressed with your client's claims of innocence. So I think you get the framing of my question.
I do. And it would have been easy for him to just say, I feel remorse for the victims, but I don't think that is this case. And I don't think that Mr. Bullock could have maintained his innocence in accordance with his Alford plea and continue to maintain his innocence while also showing remorse in any sort. I think any show of remorse would have been an acceptance of guilt as well. This case is different. And there are certainly cases, Soto is one of them, where it would be easy to see where if it was like a mistaken identity case, or in Soto where the defendant was claiming that his conduct wasn't actually illegal, for a defendant to show remorse and express remorse but not actually accept guilt. But I don't think that's this case because of the facts that you have that you've stated. The allegation is that he pointed a weapon at several different alleged victims. He claims, though, that he didn't possess a weapon when he was outside that night. And while he did have weapons in his possession, it's certainly understandable that his neighbors that he lived across from for many years would know what kind of weapons he has. So when it is Mr. Bullock saying, I didn't possess a weapon that night, and the neighbor saying, you did possess a weapon and you did point it at me, there's no way he could have expressed remorse for his actions that night without also accepting guilt.
Well, the district court seemed to be focusing not on remorse for conduct, remorse for breaking the law, but remorse for the effect that whatever your client did had some apparent significant impact on the child victim in particular.
Sure. And again, I do think in many other cases, it'd be easy to see how a defendant could express remorse for his conduct that night. But any expressive remorse would be tied to the fact that Mr. Bullock must have pointed a weapon at them. And again, that's what Mr. Bullock has maintained throughout the entirety of this case, that he did not possess a weapon and never pointed a weapon at anyone. So to say, I'm sorry that you had a weapon pointed at you, I think would be an acceptance of guilt. And so I don't think you could get to a point of Mr. Bullock expressing remorse without also saying Mr. Bullock must have had a weapon on him that night and must have pointed it at these alleged victims. And I do want to move into all the positive things that Mr. Bullock had done, because that's the first thing that strikes me when I read this case. And I think it's the first thing that strikes a lot of people.
Let me pause you for just one moment. If you could, and maybe you'll get into this with what you're about to address, but do you believe that there are circumstances in this case that would compel a finding of particular amenability to probation? Not just support, but would compel the district court to so find?
Yes, and I do believe all the trog factors are met short of that remorse. And specifically, the judge at the district court didn't address any of those factors in a negative light. None of them were addressed in a negative light. All of them were addressed by the district court, or either not addressed in her decision or addressed in a positive light, specifically the particularly amenable to treatment and her commending Mr. Bullock for taking the initiative, getting into treatment and taking it seriously and doing well. I think the district court was understandably skeptical of Mr. Bullock going to treatment,
isn't it true that there wasn't any evidence that alcohol was involved in this particular proceeding? I mean, he in fact denied consuming any alcohol that evening.
That is correct. And in the complaint, it does reference that Mr. Bullock does drink every day. But like you said, Mr. Bullock denied that he was under the influence of alcohol. That said, during his over 2 years while this case was pending, where he had no criminal activity, no issues with any probation or any pretrial services or anything like that, he did realize that he does have a problem with alcohol. And the district court commended him for that and taking the initiative and saying, hey, I do have a problem with alcohol. During COVID and during losing his father-in-law, he came to the realization that I have a problem with alcohol and I should address that. I think that alone makes him particularly amenable to treatment, saying, hey, I have an issue. I'm going to address it on my own and take the initiative and responsibility for this.
What should our disposition be if we were convinced that your legal argument is correct? Or your understanding of what the district court was saying is correct about the basis for denying the downward departure. But we were to look at the record and see as a matter of law and decide as a matter of law that there is no sufficient evidence of a particular amenability to probation.
What I would ask that if... Yeah, a reverse and remand with a direction that, number one, remorse is
why would
not.
Why would it matter, though, if we didn't find any basis for the district court to have found particular amenability to probation?
The district court made clear, and I think, again, that statement that she made on the end of page 22 and 23, that the law requires her not to find compelling circumstances to depart. And so if you found legally that she did abuse her discretion, I think it would require the district court to make findings on whether he's particularly amenable to probation, because she didn't make those findings specifically. The only finding she made was the law doesn't require me because you haven't shown remorse. And if we find that that's an abuse of discretion, based on that, I think the district court does need to make more findings as to his particularly amenability, with direction that remorse is not a necessary condition for a dispositional departure. I see that my time has run. Would it be okay if Judge Larkin asked a question to answer that?
Oh, I didn't know that she had a question. Yes, please.
I just saw her hand up.
Go ahead.
Can I ask it now and then it can be addressed on rebuttal?
Certainly.
Yeah, I'm struggling with the notion that we would remand for the district court to make findings explaining its decision not to depart, because I'm not aware of any law, rule, statute, case law that requires a district court judge to give reasons for not departing. A district court judge has to make written findings supporting a departure, but I'm not aware of any authority saying the judge must do something along those lines to deny a departure. The only requirement I'm aware of is the one that says a judge is obligated to consider the arguments for and against departure. And I think that's the only time we've reversed one of these, is when a judge failed to do that. So maybe you could address that, your suggestion that there's a findings requirement on remand.
And you'll
Thank
have,
you, Judge Larkin.
On rebuttal, you'll have the 5 minutes. And we'll
Thank
turn
you.
Over then to the state.
May it please the court. My name is Jeffrey Wald, and I represent respondent, State of Minnesota, in this appeal. This case presents a very straightforward question. Did Judge Kelly Olmstead abuse her discretion when she denied appellant's motion for a dispositional departure? The answer to that question is no, for three reasons. First, the record clearly shows that Judge Olmstead thoroughly considered appellant's argument. In fact, she'd been reviewing the motion and some of the exhibits for approximately 1 year at the time of sentencing. Case law is clear. Judge Olmstead was not required to grant a dispositional departure, even if all of the trog factors were present. She was merely required to correctly apply the law and fully consider appellant's motion, which she did. Second, even under Soto itself, on which appellant hangs his hat, remorse can be considered a relevant factor when a defendant makes an Elford plea. And third, contrary to appellant's argument, Judge Olmstead did not condition a dispositional departure on appellant showing remorse, nor did she misapply the law and claim that she could not grant him a dispositional departure unless he showed remorse. Instead, consistent with Soto and other case law, Judge Olmstead looked at appellant's lack of remorse as just one of several factors why he was not particularly amenable to probation. Because there was
Is there some language in the district court's analysis that would help us to reach the conclusion that you're asserting, which is that the district court did not find the lack of remorse the sine qua non of the decision.
Yes, Your Honor. And I quoted this in my brief. But if you go to page 22 of the sentencing transcript, Judge Olmstead does a couple of important things there. First, she recognizes the tension between a defendant making an Alford plea on the one hand and looking at a dispositional departure, one of the factors, of course, being remorse. So contrary to appellant's contention that she blindly thought that she could not depart because this was a situation where there was an Alford plea, she recognized there's a tension here. But then she went on to say, but it's very, very difficult for me to not at least hear from you that you can acknowledge the pain that the victims here have experienced. And she had that comment like that a couple of times. And so I think
it's right. I'm trying to understand the basis on which a district court would weigh as a factor a lack of a showing of remorse based upon the victim's reaction to conduct that the defendant is saying was not criminal conduct.
And that's what I believe Judge Olmstead, part of what she's doing here is she's not simply saying you haven't shown remorse, feeling sorry for something that you have done, remorse at your conduct, an acknowledgement of some level of guilt.
Right.
On the one hand.
But he's asserting that he has no level of guilt, that there's nothing in his conduct that is for which he's criminally culpable. So if that's the case, how would one show remorse without acknowledging, as the district court framed it, it was remorse for your behavior that contributed to the feelings of the victims or something. I'm paraphrasing here. So, but is that, am I correct that that's what the district court said?
And that's what I'm trying to get at, Judge Ross, is that that wasn't solely what she was saying. She wasn't simply saying, look, you did this act that caused this pain. If you read the transcript, what she's saying is you can't even acknowledge the pain that these people have suffered, regardless of it.
Why? Why would that be relevant to, why would that be an obligation on a defendant? If someone has some pain and suffering that the defendant is saying the defendant didn't cause, why would it bear upon the sentence whether or not he feels bad about their reaction to conduct that was not a crime, according to the defendant?
Because it goes to whether the defendant is amenable, particularly amenable to probation, to rehabilitation.
Yeah. Oh.
Mr. Wald, my understanding is that although he denied having the firearm or having anything to do with the laser being pointed, that he did say to the police officers that he had made a hand gesture or something to replicate or to look as if he was holding a gun. Is that not enough to say, gee, if I did that, you know, even if you made some gesture that people would have such a reaction, is that not a link to why he should feel some remorse for their injuries?
Correct, Judge Workey. So I think that there's a couple of things going on. Back to Judge Ross's earlier question to appellant, Judge Olmstead, if you read the transcript, it seems clear to me that she didn't buy that appellant was completely innocent, that there was significant evidence that he was a bad actor in this whole offense, and that he never took responsibility, nothing, not even for going outside and having some sort of altercation, even if he did not believe that it rose to some level of a criminal offense.
What's your assessment of the law on that question? I asked Mr. Kittle the question, and I'm not sure if we've had case law on it. What happens if the record, unlike your, you know, maybe a typical Alford plea where, or more typical Alford plea where the evidence isn't so corroborative, where it really depends upon individuals' words. Here you've got weapons that are found in the defendant's home that happen to have a laser sight consistent with the red illumination that they're, the dot that the victim said appeared inside their home. And the guns match the description of the ones that they said were pointed at them. So, I mean, can the district court take the Alford plea on the one hand and say, well, you're allowed to plead guilty, but I'm not required to accept that you're innocent, that as it regards acceptance of responsibility. If we had a case on that point, and what's the logic either way and the law either way on how that's to be approached?
I'm not aware of any case law, and it could have just escaped my attention one way or the other. Certainly appellant has not cited any authority to say that, look, when you plead via Alford, you can't look at the conduct. The judge has to assume that I am in fact guilty. That certainly is not the law. He has cited no case law. And the logic would be, I think that, look, the judge is in the best situation to assess all of the evidence. It's the judge who has to determine whether there is sufficient evidence to accept the Alford plea in the first place. And even under Soto, remorse is a relevant factor. And if remorse is a relevant factor, it would indicate to me that the judge can look at the strength of the case and determine whether remorse is something that ought to be present. If the judge could not look at remorse as a relevant factor, that would indicate that, no, you don't get a look at whether this was in fact a crime or not, whether I believe that a offense happened. And certainly if a district court judge believes that there was not a crime, that the defendant is in fact innocent, the district court judge shouldn't be accepting the Alford plea in the first place. So it would seem that the logic would be that a district court judge who's in the best position should be able to examine the facts. And especially here where you have two very compelling victim impact statements that describe not only the conduct in the night in question, but the continuing conduct of appellant to make life miserable to the point where the victims had to leave the neighborhood and the ongoing damage that they suffered at the hand of appellant. If there's no further questions, Your Honors, I would simply ask.
I do have a follow-up question.
Sure, Judge Ross.
Can you address particular amenability to probation? I mean, the district court did not expressly find either way. What is your position on the argument that if we agree the district court overemphasized as a matter of law the remorse, lack of remorse, what are we to do at that point, as far as a disposition? Should we look to the record and see whether there was evidence of particular amenability to probation, or should we send it back to the district court for a finding on that point?
If you find that there was an error as a matter of law, I think the appropriate disposition would be to send it back to the district court to correctly apply the law. Judge Olmstead was not required to make a finding of not particularly amenability to probation, but she did make a finding that there were no substantial and compelling circumstances. So maybe I'm arguing against myself here, but if there was an error as a matter of law, I do think you'd have to remand for Judge Olmstead to correctly apply the law. But for the reasons that I already articulated, she did not incorrectly apply the law. She did exactly.
So just so we're clear, the state is not making any harmless error argument.
I am not making a harmless error argument. No.
Any other questions from the panel judges? It appears not. Mr. Wall, thank you. And we'll turn it back over now to Mr. Kittel for, I'm sorry, Kittel for rebuttal. And I want to remind you that you have a question that's posed by Judge Larkin.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I do want to start off by addressing that question from Judge Larkin. And I think Mr. Wald even talked about it at the end there as well. If there's a finding that the district court did erroneously view the law, and specifically on the issue of making remorse a necessary condition, that abuse of discretion, I believe, would require reverse and remand. And just as Judge Ross kind of suggested, the district court didn't make a finding of whether or not Mr. Bullock was particularly amenable. The finding very specifically was, I can't depart since you didn't show remorse. And she backed that up later in her decision by saying, legally, I can't depart. And going back, it's because he didn't show remorse. Just as the Court of Appeals did in Soto, making remorse a necessary condition was an error. It was an erroneous view of the law.
So we're clear. Your argument would fail if we concluded or we interpreted the district court statement not as saying, I can't give you the departure because you didn't show remorse, but the district court was instead saying, I can't find that you showed remorse because you failed to take responsibility for the effect your behavior had.
Even if...
You agree there are two ways that could be interpreted, correct?
I do. And so if it's interpreted that it was the judge, Judge Olmstead, deciding that legally she had no way to depart since there was no remorse, I think it's clearly erroneous based on the Supreme Court's finding in Soto. But even if this court treats it as the district court's personal decision that since she didn't hear him say, I'm sorry, where he pled guilty to an Alford plea and the district court was well aware he was maintaining his innocence, I still believe that does go against all logic and facts on the record. And so it is still an abuse of discretion and should still go back to the district court for further findings on particularly amenable. Judge Larkin.
An Alford plea is an Alford guilty plea. And that's the way it's written in the rules. We treat it as a guilty plea. So even though he's maintaining his innocence, he's pleaded guilty. So what's wrong with the judge treating him as someone who has pleaded guilty and who is guilty of the crime?
Number one, it's the fact that the judge made remorse a necessary condition, saying that I cannot depart because he didn't show remorse. But number two, it does go against logic and facts on the record for her to accept the plea, knowing he's going to be arguing for a dispositional departure, knowing he's been maintaining his innocence throughout the entire case, and to essentially say, even though I'm accepting this plea, knowing you're arguing for a departure, there's no way I'm going to be granting this because you're pleading guilty pursuant to Alfred unless you come back here and tell me you were lying all along. That goes against logic and it goes against the facts on the record in the face of all the positive things that Mr. Bullock had done, not only in his 53 years in life with zero criminal history and over the 2 years spent while this case was pending. No issues, no missing court appearances. His wife was at every court appearance with him. He had strong letters from his neighbor.
I'm just trying to figure out if we do what you're asking us to do, how it plays out. We'd essentially be saying you can have a downward dispositional departure for a crime, even though you're guilty, if you have no remorse.
That would be the finding. And I believe that's the finding that the Soto Supreme Court came to as well. The Court of Appeals in Soto made.
What language in Soto supports that conclusion?
The Supreme Court in Soto stated that the Court of Appeals erred in making remorse a necessary condition, just as the district court did here. Remorse can be used as a factor, but it is not a necessary condition for any downward dispositional departure. And so for the district court to essentially find that because he pled guilty pursuant to Alfred, he's automatically categorically barred from a downward dispositional departure is an abuse of discretion. And so we, based on all of those factors, and because it was an abuse of discretion, we would ask that the sentence be reversed, remanded to the district court, either for imposition of a probationary sentence or for further findings on his particular amenability to probation. I do see that time is about to run out, but if there are any other questions.
It appears not. Again, thank you to both counsel for doing a last minute change and appearing by on our Zoom platform today. The matters are submitted and a decision will be issued within the statutory timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you very much.